Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
An obscure body in the SK system, Your Majesty. The inhabitants refer to it as the planet Earth.
I like to play with things a while before annihilation. Pathetic Earthlings! Who can save you now? Flash! Remove the Earth Woman. Prepare her for our pleasure.
Don't kill him yet, Father. I warned him.
This weekend, I got a couple of, I went to a friend's house with a couple of friends, and we sat and we watched Flash Gordon. This is the 1980s Flash Gordon, for those aficionados who might be saying, oh God, is he talking about the 1951 version? Is he talking about the 1933 version? Is he talking about the 98, was it 99? I can't remember when they did that terrible TV show version. Or is he talking about the Filmation version?
The 70s cartoon as well.
I know, just saying that, the Filmation version as well, which has links to the film as well, in pre-production, I believe.
Nice.
So there's a lot of Flash Gordon to talk about. And all of it, to be fair, is interesting. The serials are interesting. The relevance of the TV series in the 50s has actually got a lot of stuff behind it, which is very interesting to do with the time. And the whole thing of the financing and how they were using Germany to film it, because Germany had frozen assets after the war, so it made a very, very good place to go and film stuff. So there's all these Flash Gordons have got some really interesting stuff behind them. But we're talking about 1980s, which I believe, given that Gareth largely remains time-locked between 1977 and 1979, production at least fits in there, doesn't it? Would you not agree? You are time-locked, largely.
Well, yes, I do go back to that sort of golden special place, I suppose. That is my San Bernardino. It is the place of it's an unbroken place of quality, culturally. And the interesting thing is, Britain is a pretty miserable place at that time, but our TV is never better. And perhaps when times are at their worst, our TV is at its best.
Doesn't seem to be at the moment.
Well, but it's not 1979 bad, you know. You know, we moan because, you know, some people are unhappy because wages have not gone up with inflation. Inflation was double digits back then, and you know, there were bin bags piled high in Trafalgar Square.
So I mean, you
couldn't imagine that now. So it was a different kind of terrible, I would say.
That was like a
savage beating one evening, whereas this is like a migraine that's gone on for years. They're both horrible, but in different ways.
So we need a little bit more of a double digits in the inflation before little and large pull themselves out of the grave that they're not actually in, but should be, probably. I don't know.
It is surprising that they're not there. You know, if you were laying a sort of sweepstake of people who should be dead by now, you would expect the incredibly healthy vegan David Bowie to have gone on forever, and little and large to have not made it out the 80s, and yet here we are.
Well, to be fair, David Bowie, while he was a vegan, did spend 30 to 40 years pumping his body full of God knows what sort of narcotics. So he did have that offset to his health diet. So
true.
Anyway, this is a film which surprisingly actually hasn't got David Bowie in it, because you'd feel in some respects it's the sort of film you'd imagine him turning up. It has that sort of larger than life quality. The Dino De Laurentiis 1980s Flash Gordon starring Sam J. Jones, Melody Anderson, and of course probably most famous of all, Brian Blessed. Which, having rewatched it with friends, you really realise how important Brian is to that film. And if you listen to bits of his commentary as well, you can see that love he has for that film as well.
Well, I think his love goes back to those early serials, the Saturday mornings in at the pictures in
yes.
Doncaster. And I think he always used to play Prince Voltan and jump off ledges and railway sidings pretending to be able to fly. So I guess that's a dream role, really.
It's a kind of a fascinating one, so far as the sense that most kids, and it just speaks for Brian Blessed, would want to be Flash Gordon. I'm trying to think back to the 30s versions. I can't remember whether Voltan was bearded. I'm pretty sure. You know, sort of bearded, boisterous characters don't tend to be the ones that kids gravitate to.
Well, yeah, but, you know, I remember the pecking order in the playground. You know, I never got to be Han Solo or Luke Skywalker. You know, I had to take the character parts. I was quite often Moff Tarkin. and, you know, I remember in Jaws, I seem to remember playing Hooper, because no one wanted that part. So you made those parts your own. So maybe Brian was just being a bit clever there by taking what is on paper, you know, just a sort of space Viking, and putting something of himself in there. So a shrewd move. I mean, who really remembers Prince Baron?
Well, absolutely. True. I remember when I was in the playground, I used to play Rogue Trooper, where you had genetic infantry, which were all clones, which actually, thinking back, was a bloody good move, because everyone could play the same character. But going back to Flash Gordon, I mean, we had a long talk last night. I mean, there's loads of things in Flash Gordon you can talk about. I think, in a weird way, it's one of those sort of films which is, obviously we're going to say, hugely underrated, but I think it's a film which is hugely undervalued as well. I think, as a culture, we're so critically snobbish over what good films should be like or should stand for, what qualities they should have. Films like Flash Gordon, which have got a lot of really good qualities in there, sort of get kicked under the radar.
I would disagree completely. I mean, let's turn this on its head. This is the season 17 versus Dennis Potter argument here. You know, people like Dennis Potter, and Jonathan Powell with Tinker Tailor were making extraordinary television in 1979. But I am willing to bet this year more people will have watched a season 17 Tom Baker at least once, probably 10,000 times more than people have watched Tinker Tailor or some of the really worthy television that would have made the headlines. And it's the same with Flash Gordon. If you think back to films from 1980 that people are still watching and talking about, I can't think of a single one other than Flash Gordon from 1980 that people are still talking about and excited. It's Empire Strikes Back. It's arguably a 1979 film, isn't it?
Oh, we're going down to the Star Wars, the 1977 film rather than 1978, depending on which place you come from. But that's what I mean. I agree with you. I mean, I think it is a massively... Yeah. But that people would still not acknowledge its relevance or its value. I think relevance people could, because they'll say, yeah, I like it, it's good to watch. But they won't actually admit that just it is actually really good to watch in a different way to what Tinker Tailor would be. And I think that's the issue that sort of springs to me when I watch it. I was thinking, there is so much in this which I can rate. There are things in here I can knock to pieces. But you can do that with most films if you really want to look for things. But films which do this, in a sense, I think are kind of harder. It's sort of I was talking to someone else the other day, it's the Broadchurch factor. I mean, people go, oh, God, the drama in that is so intense. And you think, yeah, well, if you're dealing with rape or you're dealing with the loss of a child, that sort of drama sort of writes itself to some degree, because it's so emotive, so powerful. It sort of doesn't need that much work. It's just making sure you don't make the wrong moves. It's easy to make the right moves. But with something like Flash Gordon, which is so outlandish, hitting that tone, and again, we know that the film was under massive stresses in production and pre-production. So there was issues there anyway. But to actually get something which really stands out, as you say, for like 35 years, it's quite incredible.
Well, it's a beautiful mix of things that just happen to be right, because they make... I think that... I think for years, certainly in the 80s, I liked Flash Gordon because I was attached to it. But for most people I knew who were a little bit older, or in fact my age, and had moved on from the sci-fi thing because that was for kids, it was just seen as a Queen album that had a movie attached to it. And I think now we're able to see almost in all the senses. The Queen soundtrack's incredibly important. It is wonderful. The aesthetic choices that they made in terms of design, the rich colours, the campiness, the gaudiness, they take what's slightly ludicrous about the 30s one. I mean, I remember getting very annoyed as a kid with the 30s ones on BBC when they were in space and Flash would sort of just open a window and pop his head out and fire a gun at the rocket behind them. So they kind of give it a solidity, but still keep the aesthetic, which is why I think it could never, ever, ever be remade in any way, shape or form. And then there's the joyous performances, which are just, you know, I mean, I think Max von Sydow's Ming is extraordinarily good on every level. You know, the humour, the menace, the stillness, the little gestures. Their quality ingredients, but it has taken almost 30 years to reach maturation. I don't remember it causing a big splash when it came out. I mean, it's one of the few Panini sticker albums that I completed.
I tried.
I remember by the end, it was really hard to find the stickers. And there was no one left in the playground to swap with because they'd all given up. I think there was only Lee Bassett left in my playground who was swapping stuff. So I think it came and went and dropped off the radar very quickly, because it was probably the same summer as, it would have been the same summer as Superman 2, which I think would have been the bigger film. And it probably would have been the same summer. Was it the same summer?
Well, I'm just trying to think for us. I think for us, was it the summer of 80 or was it the summer of 79 for UK? I need to check.
I think the Americans got it in at Christmas 79, and I think we got it in springtime.
I'm just having a...
I don't remember if well, summer movie, I'm be wrong.
I think I'm like a year or two younger than you, so it was a little, a little... I'm the same as Christian, so... release date United Kingdom was 10th of December 1980, apparently. It was late, later than I realised as well. That's verging on 81. Well, we all learned something new on air. How embarrassing.
Okay.
I had the same thing with the sticker album. I mean, I was living in Chipping Norton at the time. Now home to the Camerons and Top Gear's chief.
Is that so? I always thought it was one of those comedy places like
Nottingham. No, Chipping Norton is one of those highbrow Oxfordshires where the rich live quite well and the poor live quite poorly, I think. But I was living in Chipping Norton. I remember sort of going to the local shop there and buying the stickers and desperate for photos of the rocket cycle. I have a feeling it was one of those things as a kid I didn't actually see till later, but I'd heard and seen the trailers and I had the album. on LP.
Yeah.
So it had a lot of meaning to me, and I remember actually getting the VHS video at my granddad's to see it on rental and sort of watching it over and over and over again. So there's no doubt it has a lot of meaning for me as a kid. But I think you're right. I mean, there's so many levels in it. Watching as an adult and having experience of both the Alex Raymond strips and the 30s serials in particular, I think what is particularly good about Sydow's performance is that while there's a very clear, shall we say, Eastern threat influence in the generation of Ming in the 30s, he plays none of that. I mean, it takes him a bit away. I think in the 30s, his god is Tao, which is a sort of, has a sort of a very strong, sort of Chinese, reference to it. And they change it in the 1980s, but he doesn't play it. They don't really make him try it. They don't try and sort of give him a sort of Chinese look to him, which I think was maybe very clear in the original. So somehow he manages to own that part without feeling like he's stealing the part or making it his own. He somehow finds that bridge, that tension between making it authentic, but making it him, and alien, because it doesn't feel like it's couched in any terms of any particular fascism or particular region. And I think that was brilliant about it. And his script is really good as well. I think it's kind of funny. And I think this is where I think some people get Flash Gordon wrong. And I know, again, we've got to be careful about not making this over... overscribing its brilliance as intended, because there's so much improvised and pushed out, you know, near the time of going into production. But his dialogue is very different to, say, Flash and Dale's, which sort of shows you that in the screenplay there was a deliberate interest in trying to make Flash and Dale sort of fairly dumb and innocent, you know, innocence abroad, while Ming's dialogue is actually very rich and quite brutal. That I've always loved about it.
Yeah, he has some singing lines, doesn't he? And some great scenes. I mean, it's and you can just hear the delivery.
Yeah.
You know, I'm probably the scene that I watch and it always makes me laugh is the wedding with Dale. And the poor little priest, you know, do you promise to use her as you will? Certainly. Not to blast her into space. And then it's like, look, like, what's all this? Until you grow weary of her, you know, and all that is just, it's very good. And actually, as you say, that some of the dialogue and performance and gravitas, the little scene where Ming makes Flash the offer, of, you know, he's basically offering him a moon and to become a vassal state and the delivery and just the little, that little moment where he boots the gobbler off, you know, off the base is just, it's subtle and it's understated, and it'd be so easy to go over the top. You know, I still think in Waking Nightmares, when you think how John Peters for years tried to get a remake off the ground in the 90s and was determined to have Jack Nicholson as Ming, and it just would have been wrong on every level.
Yeah, absolutely.
It would have been just absolutely wrong. Although maybe it wouldn't have been, because I understand when he was cast as the Joker, the Batman, you know, ultras were up in arms that this was wrong and it must be Peter O'Toole or nobody, because aesthetically Jack Nicholson was wrong, and yet he gives a very good performance.
He does, yes, absolutely.
Joker, so
no, I know what you mean.
Perhaps. Although, you know, I think in reality it would have been a mess, that John Peter, an interesting mess, but a mess. A John Peters remake.
Absolutely. And I think one of the beautiful things about the film as well is that it, to some degree, has a certain, there's a certain allowance for it to be sort of slightly kooky and silly, because again, something that Hodges sort of admits, the director, in many interviews, is that from his reflection, he kind of felt that the comic strips, you know, he said he was focused on the King's Features comic strip rather than the serial, was sort of slightly kooky. These characters were fairly superficial, that Flash doesn't really have any particular, and he doesn't in the serial either, there's no real particular motivation behind apart from saving the universe. That sort of skill is acquired quite quickly with no background to it. There's no base to them. And so with that sort of rationale behind it, and that sort of quick moving new strip pace that you get, you can allow for the sort of conceits you get in the films, like we talked about last night, when the Hawkman city is being destroyed and he sort of accidentally slips down a chute which delivers him to a Hawkman rocket cycle which shoots him off into the next act, essentially. And that is very new strippy.
That's true. Shall I tell you what I think we touched on it last night, and I also think that they get completely right with this. And it's something that Doctor Who could certainly, I think, take a leaf out of Flash Gordon's book, is what they do is that the villains and the professional evil in this, so I'm thinking of Clitus and General Kallar, they're all actually rather good at their job. They're not idiots. You know, General Kallar, I don't think puts a foot wrong all the way through. You know, even with, you know, oh, War Rocket Ajax is on its way back. Have we heard from it? No. That's odd. You know, is it in the right flat pattern? Oh, no. Oh, right, that's very odd. Right, it, obviously something's gone wrong. Open fire, all weapons. And you think, great. And then she does that line where she delivers it brilliantly, but she goes, I take supreme responsibility in the Emperor's name, or personal responsibility. And I thought, bloody hell. And Clytus, again, very good at his job, very professional. Ming surrounds himself with good people. We're lucky that President Trump doesn't have such good taste in his hires. Because, you know, Ming has been through, you know, he's been through the LinkedIn of professional evil, and he's hired very, very well. And I think that that gives it a credibility, because to overcome this professional evil, it brings out the very best in all of our, in all of our heroes in the story. But it's difficult not to root at some level for Clytus and General Carlo when it's delivered with such lip-smacking relish. Every line is just is beautiful. And I IMDb'd, gosh, who's the actress? Marianella, gosh, it's awful, I can't remember, who plays Carla. A very well-respected Italian actor who thought that Flash was going to be the breakthrough into Hollywood, and it never happened. But for that one moment, we get this perfect
performance. It is, absolutely. I mean, the performances are good all round. I mean, I think where the film is let down, maybe in the writing of it, is within Flash. And I'm not talking so much about his, as I say, this sort of two-dimensional character that he is in the film, but more in the fact that, and I've read this somewhere, and someone remarked on this, and it's very true, that he's not a horrendously proactive character, that he sort of almost sort of ambles through the film like Inspector Gadget, from one scene to the other. He doesn't really, I mean, he does sort of almost like passively sort of interact with people, sort of, you know, occasionally saying, we've got to team up and fight them, you know, I'm not your enemy. But ultimately, he does sort of feel like he's sort of dragged through the film until he gets to War Rocket Ajax.
Well, to a degree. And actually, we're lucky. I mean, he's lucky that he's obviously a good-looking chap, and Princess Ardala takes a shine to him, because if she doesn't fancy him, then he dies in a cage a third of the way through, and actually, that's it. There's an interesting spin-off to be done with you know, Dale's life as Ming's seventh wife, which would be interesting, and would have, you know, I can just see Dale drinking gin all day, and watching the TV with the other wives and working out if they're going to kill
Ming. Something
like
Mongo
evening.
Dallas, actually, could have spawned from it.
Yeah.
He killed JR.
Mongo Dallas, and I guess, and Zarkov, well, I suppose he probably takes over from Clytus. Clytus probably takes a tumble and ends up in an ice cave on Phrygia, and Zarkov is the head of the secret police. I can see that. Oh, so yeah, the whole thing, it's interesting, because the whole thing doesn't turn on Ming fancying Dale. It turns on the fact that Ardala has a crush on Flash, and that's what saves the Earth. It's an interesting twist, which I never thought of.
The other thing I quite like about it as well, and I never noticed this as a kid, but I noticed it as an adult, probably because, and this is a very interesting thing where you're sort of the associated sort of texts around the main one sort of become really active. And that I was so keyed into the LP, because that was what I listened to the whole time, which was a mixture of the Queen soundtrack with hints of sound, of speech that sort of segue between the music.
It was a good way to
experience
the film.
It was, but it sort of deceived me and it distorted it. And what I do like in the film, which isn't on the LP as per se, is that if Baron doesn't destroy the deflector shield, then Ajax hits the deflector shield, blows up, hopefully kills the deflector shield, Hawkman swoop in and maybe win. But the beautiful thing there is that while Flash has a sort of lead role in it, because there's a sort of slight realism to the film that he is not singularly the one who saves everything, you know, again, and maybe this is where I think some people criticize the film is that it does sort of or perhaps diminish his role in comparison to what the Flash soundtrack is singing throughout, that he is king of the impossible, he is a miracle and all this. And yet actually he's activated by, as you say, you know, Princess Adala's love for him, Baron able to knock down the energy shield, Zarkov as well, to some degree, has some involvement. yeah. everyone else. Are, it's an ensemble thing which defeats Ming, and yet the soundtrack is quite clearly saying it's just Flash. And I sometimes wonder if that, on some sort of very subliminal level, makes you kind of feel that there's a sort of disconnect here between what the film is crying out as its rhetoric and what you're seeing on the thing, which is a far more, sort of, as I say, an ensemble Star Warsy thing than a singular hero.
I wonder if this reflects its far more British roots. You know, if George Lucas was telling this story, then Flash would have snuck back into the city on his Hawkman rocket cycle. He probably would have followed Baron's trajectory inside mm-hmm. the city, rescuing people, cutting off the lightning shield to let in the Hawkman, and then probably would have grabbed that great big huge comedy golden sword that was always on the foot of the album sticker album, and had a good old fashioned sword fight
like
with
Ming
and Spark, and then killed him. That probably would have been, it would have had a far more linear hero's journey than, as you say, this very satisfying, almost ensemble piece where Baron and Voltan and everyone gets to play a meaningful part in our denouement. I also wonder, and I might be cynical here, when Sam J. Jones, bless him, is the lowest ranked actor in the whole piece by a long way. He's playing the lead, but in terms of box office, he's not it. And if the poor bugger doesn't even get his own voice in it, which I didn't realize for years after. And that must be horrible for Sam Jones to watch someone else.
It's kind of good to watch it and try and work out, because some of them are his, I think, because it was only in the ADR that he couldn't participate because of the dispute he had with Dino at the time. But
is that what it was? Dino just got rid of him.
Yeah,
altogether.
I'm not sure whether that was control, because there was a legal dispute meant that he couldn't come in and do the ADR stuff, so they had to get another voice actor in to do it. But I think there's a couple of lines in there which are his. No one knows, apparently. It's an unknown voice actor. No one knows who actually does Flash's voice. But because...
And yet, that is such a distinctive voice.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
extraordinary. It's a little bit like the thing that no one's ever seen either, which is is Lou Grade's recut of The Long Good Friday, where David Dacre was dubbed over Bob Hoskins. And that was where Lou Grade basically saw The Long Good Friday and went, oh my God, you guys have made a pro-IRA film. I'm not having this. I'm going to bury this. So Lou Grade looked at recutting it as a two-part TV drama, which sounds ludicrous now, and decided to redub Bob Hoskins with Brummy David Dacre. And this was the point where Grade didn't realise that he transgressed one of the clauses in Bob Hoskins' contract that says you can't be redubbed without your permission. And it allowed them to put in motion the action that let them take back, that let Handmade buy the copyright of the film from Lou Grade. But, God, poor old Sam J. Jones clearly didn't have that right.
No, and that was an interesting thing again, which some say that maybe you could argue, one could argue that Sam J. Jones destroyed the film in the sense that because he was in this dispute, and I believe it might have been a money dispute, pay dispute, with Dino, which meant he couldn't do the ADR. He also meant that he was unable to do any of the US promotional. And so this film goes to the US, and it's largely promoted on Max, and the visual images of Ming. There's very few images where Flash is at the forefront.
That's very true.
And whether again,
That's true. The British posters, which are a little bit anodyne actually, are mostly Flash. All the US pictures are all Ming, which are beautiful. That makes a lot of sense.
That's a quite interesting. And I think that was the one territory where it didn't sell. I think it sold quite well here and in Europe, but it was in the States it didn't. And again, is that a question that you lack the hero factor on the promotional material? So,
I'm willing to bet it was just a little bit too camp for them.
Okay. Yes. Sorry, I was just trying to bring Christian in. and just talk about how it, some of the failures. Interestingly enough, just carrying on, Christian Crawley has just joined us, if you haven't worked out from this intrusion.
Prince Baron Radcar.
Since then, Sam J. Jones has apparently apologised. Dino, there's an interview where he says he rung Dino up and actually said, you know, I might have made a big mistake there, that I was being, you know, I was making a, perhaps I made a bad call on who to listen to and who to push with, you know, who was in his circle, his agent and everything else. And if that had happened, you do wonder whether it might have done better at the US box office. As you say, Gareth, maybe it was too camp, but if it hadn't...
I think totally it would have been too camp for them. It was, it's very European in its sensibility, and I can imagine the Japanese appreciating it in terms of the design and the aesthetic, and indeed the humour. But it's not a very American picture, is it?
Maybe that was another mistake in it. Maybe Sam J. Jones was a mistake. I know Sam J. Jones is obviously there to really sell it to the American market, but if you'd had a sort of British Flash and you'd made it a very British film, a camp British film, maybe it could have sold on that sort of Anglophile level, which is sort of kind of lost where you've got Melody and Sam being sort of, you know, the American front pieces to it. Oh, Christian, what do you think about Flash? We haven't asked you that.
I love it.
Is this...
I always have done.
Is this because of your age? Because, you know, being the same group?
It may be because of my age. I don't remember when I first watched it, but I do remember it being on BBC in 1987 on the bank holiday, August bank holiday. And I recorded it when it was on. So I think I'd probably seen it before that, but not properly. And after that, I watched it over and over again. So, yeah, I'm quite familiar with it. It's just such a fun... It's a fun film.
It is.
It doesn't take itself too seriously in the slightest. It's got a great cast, awesome soundtrack, and there's very few films can boast a soundtrack like that. You know, like done by, like the entire soundtrack album done by one, the biggest band in the world at the time, you know. So, yeah, it's a great
film. There's a lovely darkness to it as well that we might want to talk about, because it's not just camp. There's quite a lot of dark moments in that film.
There's Peter Duncan just started off getting stabbed by the wood beast.
There's a name for that beast.
I can't forget what it is.
I found it last night. There's an article which was written by...
Oh, it's the Torrent Beast, is it?
No, it's called... it's called like an empathomorph or something. I'll see if I can find the article. There's an article I was reading last night which has with... and again, he's famous British... prop set designer, I can't remember his name, who's on Flash, and he's talking about the props, and you actually see there's actually a lovely, great quarter scale wood beast prop that he worked from, which is on display on that page. She's great. I'll see if I can locate it for you. But yeah, and it's a real vicious looking thing. Like, it's almost got a giant eye at the front, which you don't see from the angle within the film. And also in that,
it's quite a brutal. It's a brutal old initiation ceremony. I mean, they must lose a fair few of their wood.
Maybe they just
breed too many men, and so they have to. Otherwise, there's just not room on our board unless they.
This is Baron's jealousy, isn't it? You know, because he's not getting it. No one else gets it. anyone that he catches eyeing at Princess Ardala, straight into the wood beast, you know, test.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, the wood beast is probably actually is just a puppet with his friend underneath it. Probably Richard O'Brien underneath there with his poison dart glove that looks like a wood beast. As you say, takes out every one of his rivals. Because let's face it, Richard O'Brien in that film is very aware of the issue of rivals and Baron, because they have a long dialogue over it. So, yeah, and you don't think you see him at the...
You play your blood pipes.
Another thing which is interesting in the film, which he goes missing, but there's some of these lovely small moments, is Munson, Sarkov's assistant, who dies.
Oh, God, yeah.
Or does it?
Isn't that Hawkins?
Yes. Huh. Well, hopefully Christian will be back in a sec.
Well, all right, here's one for you. Here's one for you we won't trouble Christian with. Now, we've all agreed quite uniquely how wonderful and special and glorious and the performances are beautiful and all these things we love about Flash Gordon, it's not a million miles away from season 17 of Doctor Who in tone and style, is it?
It's very, always comes back to you, doesn't it?
It does, but, you know, I've spied an opportunity here to crowbar it in. And, you know, are we saying that if Queen had done the soundtrack to Horns of Nymon, it would now be considered a Stone Cold classic?
I think there's certainly an argument that you could perhaps put Flash Gordon in that universe or into the Doctor Who universe of that time somehow. I'm not quite sure. Mm. I mean, because there's this argument. It's not an argument because it's never stated, but there's this suggestion, obviously, the Imperial Vortex, that wherever Mongo is, it's not actually situated within the sort of same time-space thing. So you could quite easily have Mongo as this sort of as dictatorial and as a universe conquering as the Daleks, really, but dislocated.
Yeah. Now, the interesting thing is, in, you know, Horns of Nymon has that theatricality, certainly in terms of both performance, some of the lighting, yeah. but the costume design is completely over the top. I mean, June Hudson and the work on Flash Gordon is almost interchangeable, and yet Horns of Nymon is there first. So clearly there's something in the water where they're both looking at that operatic style of design and performance, and you know, Horns of Nymon much more modest, probably made for Dino's cigar budget on Flash Gordon. Flash Gordon, obviously, better resourced, but they feel the same.
There is a similarity there, yeah. I mean, what I think works well with Flash is, you say, partially through budget, and listening to the commentary with Hodges, you know, he sort of suggests how much was sort of done on ad hoc as they were moving along. It was that sort of
right.
Production. But there is, you get what you don't get in, say, Krull, which was, you know, a couple of years later.
It's worthy.
You feel that you get quite a large, you get a feeling of how Mongo exists as a place, while with Krull you don't. Krull exists where you have this fairy tale castle, but you never see any settlements. Yeah. You never see how people live. While in Mongo, okay, you don't see massive amount of that, but you get to explore the Mongo city quite a lot. You get a certain feeling of infrastructure there. They sort of talk about how, you know, the hunter becomes hunted outside their kingdom, so you get this feeling that they stay very localized, warring with each other a bit as Ming wants. You get the feeling of the secret police, how that operates. Perhaps you don't get that much of how the people live in the capital, maybe. There's perhaps a little lack of that, but it feels fairly fleshed out for the Flash Gordon universe.
It did. It feels like a real court. It's the sort of thing that Game of Thrones does very well. And I think, really, you know, Ming's court is just a really amped up, super technicolor King's Landing with a Queen soundtrack.
Yeah.
I mean, in every way, it's an upgrade.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Are there things that we don't quite like about Flash Gordon? Are there things that really do, you know, we're loving it so much, and, you know, catch me on my off day, and I will admit there are some about season 17 absolutely. That are crap. But I'd never admit it to you because I'd never hear the end of it. But I think in the same breath, are there things in Flash that perhaps don't quite work or haven't have matured as well?
I think Dale Arden is a problem. I have issue with her. Not with Melody Anderson per se, but simply.
She settles into her potential role as Ming's concubine pretty easily.
Well, she exists. I mean, she exists in that same world as I think I said before. Sort of Margot. She's got the same Margot Kidder, Karen Allen. Of that early 80s, she's playing that sort of damsel in distress, yet hard, sort of New York woman sort of archetype. And
to a degree, but I can't, to be fair, I can't see Margot Kidder, I can't see her Lois Lane, you know, accepting that Ming's going to pop in that evening.
She is,
and give her
the weaker of the three.
I think she would have got for him with a knitting.
But she's still got that sort of I'm a New York City girl attitude that she states at the end. You still have this sudden moment where she does, and fair play to them. Yeah, she drugs one of the concubines who probably gets executed later, which.
Oh,
yeah. And then she goes on this rush escape from Ming's castle where she does these cartwheels and, you know, she plays the strong female lead.
It's the cheerleader. Actually, that's her doing her cheerleader thing. So I think she's a transitional character. I think a year later, you're right, they get her completely right with Marion yes. Ravenwood. And actually, the scene where she drinks, who's the French architect? Paul Freeman.
Yeah, under
Belloc under the table is almost exactly how they, you know, if you had your time again, that's almost exactly how you do the scene with Dale and Ming.
Yeah, that's
where she drink him under the table and escape. You're right, leaving some poor servant girl to get savagely beaten to death by Ming, who's worked himself up into a foaming lava.
She does have some of the most trite definitely. Lines. I mean, I know she allegedly improvised the go flash go at the American football fight.
Mm.
It does feel a little awkward. It's a nice idea. I do dislike when Rocket Ajax comes down to the capital. The only thing she's got to do is to go and run and save herself. Screaming as a sort of aside as she runs off. Go Flash! She's heading, you know, straight to cover. There's nothing particularly, yeah. And I think the other fact I think doesn't work in a film, and again, I know they're just playing to the comic, but just doesn't translate, is how quickly they fall in love and how creepy it is. Because he's been watching her at the hotel, and she's on the plane with him. It's his private jet, so it kind of feels like he's thinking, well, you know, it's just the pilots who are not going to be listening back here, at the front there. See if I can get this girl into this sort of pull-out couch. It feels a bit like that. And then within two scenes, they're holding hands and sort of lolling their heads in the opposite directions to where the way that the capsule's spinning. But, you know, and then suddenly, you know, by 8 hours into their relationship, they're talking about kids. And
this is true. How would we do Dale Arden?
I think that's
today,
the problem, because I think today we've still got a problem with writing female characters. She would be sassy. She would be full of one-liners that would put Flash down. Because we have this thing now, I think, where especially male writers like to celebrate womanhood by making them so quick-witted and sassy and pushy that they're no longer women. They're no longer people. They're just sort of one-line machines. They're not allowed to make mistakes. They're not allowed to do wrong things or show frailty.
Yeah, that's true.
So
she'd be putting Flash down as really a sort of great big blundering meathead.
To reinforce the strength of womanhood, which shouldn't need reinforcing. It should just need to be written in there. And that's the problem. Yeah. And so, yeah, I think she'd actually be written as badly now as maybe the 80s, as you say. They just haven't quite got to the Ravenwood level or of the sort of proactive female lead. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think of how I would like to see it written, because this is the problem, and obviously what Hodges had as a problem, is how do you translate the damsel character, which ultimately she is in the 30s, into the, at the time, the sort of the growing feminist movement in the early 80s, and how do you do it now?
Spielberg makes a good stab at it, actually, which is unusual and not being tried since with Kate Capshaw's lead in Temple of Doom, where obviously it's a reluctant lead, a reluctant hero. She holds her own, but feels credible.
Yes. Yeah.
So it isn't Marion Ravenwood, because obviously he can't follow Marion Ravenwood again. Although it's funny that he didn't bring Marion Ravenwood back for it, although I suppose it is a year earlier. It's apart from some weaknesses with Meleander, you know, with the way Dale is written and presented, I think it's pretty unique and pretty flawless. Go on to be one of the greatest films of that era for decades to come.
And I think you're right. The Cape Capshaw is an interesting one, because while I find Kate quite irritating in Temple of Doom, it does play a closer, it marinates that 80s sensibilities with the 30s or 40s damsel a lot better. I think if Melody had been able to do that a little more, was perhaps a little more feisty and a little more less devoted to, all that devotion to Flash grew rather than was just suddenly, it was just there. Maybe that was perhaps one of the film's weaknesses, that it has a lot to do, doesn't it, Flash? There's a lot to set up and a lot to get through, so it really has to push on. But maybe that needed to be a little more subtle. Maybe that was a bit...
It is. It sets an aesthetic standard and it's unique. It's a little bit like, I suppose, Gene Wilder's Willy Wonka Chocolate Factory.
Yes.
It's so bold and unique and a strong blend of all the ingredients, you know, quality British character actors, an engaging lead. You know, it visually puts it out there, and it takes a bold step and it goes with it, and it gives it a timeless quality that, gosh, I mean, you can't really compare Flash with anything, but I'm trying to think of something you might be able to compare it with. It's only a year after Saturn 3, for instance, and I bet all the magazines like Starburst would have been going, ooh, Saturn 3 quality, proper, hardcore, serious science fiction. And they'd have written off Flash as a load of pop pap. And yet, absolutely. Who knows Saturn 3 now? No one.
Well, absolutely. And you go back to Doctor Who, you can probably, as much as you know I would like to not say it, you can say the difference between season 17 and 18. The memory of the outlandish and bold, while, you know, compared to the cerebral and maybe slightly safe, sort of as it starts to try and mirror the values of Star Wars. But yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think perhaps that's where we should end, as much as I'd love to keep talking about Flash, because there's surprisingly so much you can talk about there.
So much we haven't covered. We haven't mentioned Peter Wingard once.
No.
Glory. Pariah in acting circles in the late 70s because of some of his personal activities at the time. He's glorious in that as Clitus.
And we've not mentioned Deep Roy. We've not mentioned, barely mentioned Richard O'Brien. I think there's also the argument that Hodges might sort of make. You know, we sort of say that Flash and Dale sort of their romance is fairly childish, when he was very keen on this idea that they were childish, that they were like sort of young innocents in this.
Yeah, they've cast them quite old, haven't they? Whereas actually now they would be a pair of teenagers.
That is true. That is true. But maybe that sort of works. Maybe that in a way is why Flash Gordon works for me, is that a teenager I don't feel would be so strong-headed and proactive. Yet sort of Flash is still fairly methodical and mature in some ways.
Imagine a young Patrick Swayze. Swayze would have been about 19 then. I could imagine a young Swayze taking that role and making it his own.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, that's a good one.
Yeah. But it works, and it's joyous and glorious, and, you know, I always find something to enjoy when I pop that in the Blu-ray or the DVD or the video, because I think, like you, I've bought it at least 5 times. And you now want to buy it for the Brian Blessed.
I think so, yeah. The commentary. Absolutely. His comment, I mean, it's probably just worth it for the humour of him alone. And again, like you say, it has to... It's always nice when you see a film which has had such a positive effect on those who are part of it. And they all seem to celebrate it. Hodges is quite proud of it. Sam J. Jones is very open to talk about it and seems to have good memories of it.
It's been good for all of them in the end, hasn't it? It's been good for all of them. The only other thing that I think is sad is it does mark the point precisely when Brian Blessed ceases to be an actor. Brian Blessed. Everything he does after that is a variation of Voltan.
Yeah, absolutely. But you need him in that film because, I mean, there's not many actors who could come out wearing those sort of tights, that little shorts, and just, you know, live that role.
I'll give you one who's a potential upgrade. It's Oliver Reed.
Yes, Oliver might. I'd imagine he'd been a little less tempered on set, but yeah,
he would have been super. But I think only Oliver Reed or Blessed could play that, and that's quite something.
Cool. Well, okay, we will leave this podcast. Yeah. Thank you, Gareth, for this. Maybe Flash Gordon will come up again another time. Great film, and we all wish you I can't think of something trite to say. Maybe, we all wish you here on Earth and on Mongo. No, I can't. I don't know. Buy the DVD.
Because 30 Mongo minutes, I've got to go and repair a house of the dead machine.
Don't say that. That fascinates me. What is a Mongo mile? Well, why the metric? Why the change in metric? Does it make it special? Is it less? Is it more? Anyway, okay, cool. See you later.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.